Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 239, German Corporate Control Over the American Media. We're going to begin by taking a look at television, then we're going to move on to magazine and book publishing. One of the things that clued me into the line of inquiry that I've been engaged in on For the Record programs 122, 123, 152A, 177, 189, 194, 218, 224, 226, and 238, and counting, as we're here with number 238, was the O.J. Simpson case in 1994, and also an obscure Nazi tract called Serpent's Walk. Serpent's Walk is about an SS takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century, with the SS going underground, building up their economic power, and buying into the American opinion-forming media. They certainly did go underground and built up their economic muscle, as evidenced by the deadly Bormann organization that I've spoken about so often. And they're buying into the American opinion-forming media. And the O.J. Simpson case, in my cognitive capabilities, or to my cognitive capabilities, was a manifestation of same. Serpent's Walk is put out by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, the largest and most important domestic Nazi group here in the United States. It's redundant, but what the heck. They also put out the book The Turner Diaries, the model for the Nazi group The Order, and also for Timothy McVeigh and company. And I believe that Serpent's Walk, just like The Turner Diaries, is far more than the novel it purports to be. I believe it is a blueprint and a manifesto for what has been done and what is being done. The book is authored by someone who operates under the rights under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall, and the back cover reads as follows. The good guys win sometimes. Not always, of course. They lost big in the Second World War. That war was a victory for communists, Democrats, and Jews, but everyone else lost, including millions of GIs, who were told that they were killing Germans and Japanese in order to make the world a decent place for their children to grow up, only to see things in America go from bad to much, much worse in the decades after the war. Even when the bad guys win, they sometimes grow careless and later become losers. Look what happened to the communists of Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Could the same thing happen to their erstwhile World War II allies in America? Serpent's Walk explores that possibility. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. And in this book, a couple of the Nazi faithful are talking. Actually, one was about to be converted to the Nazi cause. One of the underground Reich, or SS capital organization's members, a fellow called Wrench, this organization identifiable to veteran listeners and serious students of the Third Reich in its underground post-World War II period as the Bormann organization, Wrench is talking with Lessing and discusses the situation as follows, speaking about the SS. They realize that the world is heading toward a corporocracy. 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. Skipping down, we, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5 of them. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining. Skipping down again. About 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a supercorporation that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly, with bands and trumpets flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around, too. Not much, but little, so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats and bad guys in black SS hats, lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. And skipping down, Lessing answers, hard to get people to love death camps. And Wrench counters, we don't try. You can't erase 100 years of lying propaganda overnight. And skipping down, all we ever hear about are the poor innocent Jews and the awful Holocaust, when in fact there never was an extermination policy, a final solution, or anything like it. And Lessing answers, oh, come on, what were the gas chambers for if not for extermination? Oh, there were shootings of partisans, hangings of saboteurs, and the usual atrocities that happen in every war, but the real use of the so-called gas chambers was for decontamination, ridding the clothing of camp inmates of lice and fleas. That, by the way, is precisely the Nazi revision, Holocaust revisionist line that has been espoused by, among others, people like David Irving, who recently sued Deborah Lipstadt and her publisher, Penguin Books, the largest trade publishing arm of the British media conglomerate Pearson, and lost in British court. I've noted, though, that just as Serpent's Walk talks about one huge corporation cuddling up to another one, Bertelsmann, about whom we've spoken in the past and that figures prominently and, in fact, is the central element in this ongoing discussion of German corporate control of the American and other media, Bertelsmann is, in fact, cuddling up to Pearson with a huge TV deal and also with the Financial Times of Deutschland. In For the Record program number 238, we took a look at German corporate control over American film, and we also took a long look at the recent film The Patriot, actually the current film as I'm speaking on July 23rd of the year 2000. That movie recasts the history of the Revolutionary War and portrays the British in identical terms to the Waffen-SS, and specifically the Oradour massacre carried out by the 2nd Waffen-SS Division, the Das Reich Division, in World War II. As I mentioned at the top of this broadcast, what first put me on to the German corporate control over American publishing was reading the book Serpent's Walk, of which I had never heard, at the time that the O.J. Simpson case was going on. Serpent's Walk was sent to me by a listener, and as I watched the O.J. Simpson case and its recasting of history in a fundamentally different fashion, I became convinced that Serpent's Walk, like the Turner Diaries, put out by the same Nazi publisher, National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, was in fact a blueprint, a manifesto for what is going on. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Los Angeles Times of Monday, May 8th of the year 2000. This is headlined, The Saga of O.J.'s Last Lost Pilot, the blockbuster that never was. It's by Brian Lowry, the Times staff writer. The last name is Lowry. Again, from the LA Times of 5/8/2000, the blockbuster that never was. This reads in part as follows about the O.J. Frogman pilot. Each year around this time, television networks conclude their long and frenetic scramble to discover the next hit show. But one program to emerge from this process has never been broadcast. Even though executives were certain it would have rivaled the Super Bowl as a primetime attraction, outrating Friends and ER combined. The program is Frogmen, and in a business desperate for hits, it remains an anomaly, the blockbuster no one saw. Today, in fact, the 1994 production is merely remembered as a footnote to the O.J. Simpson murder trial, because it starred none other than Simpson himself. Frogmen has been the subject of considerable myth and legend. Its fate provides a unique display of self-restraint in an industry that seldom exercises it. The show was discussed, but never introduced as evidence during Simpson's criminal trial for the murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ronald Goldman. In a chilling echo of those killings, a scene in the 2-hour movie meant to launch the action-drama series features Simpson's character grabbing what he believes to be an intruder, the young woman turns out to be his daughter, and momentarily holding a knife to her throat. The prosecution also investigated reports that Simpson received military training, including the use of a knife, in preparing for the role. Defense attorneys sought to block the Frogman videotape's admissibility by accusing the police of misconduct by watching the pilot in the former football star's living room as they searched his house. Yet, for all its notoriety, Frogman has been kept locked in vaults at Warner Brothers. Few have seen the final product, including many of those involved, who found themselves caught in the center of a media storm, even as they watched a lucrative career opportunity ride into the sunset, hitched to Simpson's Ford Bronco. Recently, a source near the project allowed the Times to view a 25-minute presentation tape assembled by Warner Brothers in 1994 as a sales tool for convincing NBC executives to order the series. The tape consists of various scenes culled from the two-hour prototype. In most instances, when the network orders a two-hour pilot, the plan is to at least broadcast it as a movie to help defray some of the network's production costs, even if a series isn't ordered. Although Frogman was completed, it has never aired. NBC's rights have reverted back to the studio, which says it has no intention of exhibiting the show, having bought out the rights of a German company that helped to finance the project. Please note that a German company helped to finance this particular project, and again, it shows Simpson holding a knife to his ex-wife's throat. And skipping down in this particular article from the New York Times of 5/8/2000, several lines of dialogue in the pilot take on an ironic twist in light of subsequent events and the allegations against Simpson. Upon entering Costa Rica, Burke, that's the Navy frogman that Simpson plays, Burke's elite unit is surrounded by armed police. "How are the jails in Costa Rica?" one of the group asks him. Simpson would later spend more than 15 months in a Los Angeles jail. In another scene, Burke talks to his daughter about the estranged relationship with his ex-wife. "She made a mistake," he says. "I forgave her a long time ago." During his 1997 civil trial, Simpson would testify, "On June 12th, I didn't think there was any animosity between me and Nicole. None at all, but I can't say everything was hunky-dory. My attitude was still some concern about her, and I was trying to avoid her." The 25-minute Frogman presentation does not contain the scene of Simpson holding the knife to his daughter's throat, but co-stars acknowledge they did receive, as Todd Allen put it, quote, "a fair amount of training," unquote, as a preparation for the shoot. Well, obviously, the subsequent dialogue in the 1997 civil trial could not have been foreseen, but the casting of the Frogman and the German production company that financed it does raise questions in my mind about just how accurate some of my intuition was about the O.J. Simpson case when I read the book Serpent's Walk. Do note the following, skipping back to Serpent's Walk, again published by National Vanguard Books, copyright 1991, and authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph Calverhall. Lessing counters that they'll never be able to change the image of the Third Reich, and Rent says it's all how you package it. Opinion is a goddamn commodity. Skipping down, give it time. Aside from the media, we've been buying up private schools and helping some public ones through philanthropic foundations and working on the churches and the born-agains. Bear in mind that earlier he noted that they have ad agencies, media psychologists, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. One wonders whether Roland Emmerich and the movie The Patriot had something to do with that. One wonders also about the O.J. Simpson case. Now, in this particular series about German corporate control over the American media, referencing that book Serpent's Walk that I've talked about so many times, one of the central elements of discussion has been the Bertelsmann firm, with strong connections to what I call the Underground Reich, and historical connections documented to the SS. And again, the Nation magazine's issue of December 28th of 1998 talks about Bertelsmann Heinrich Mohn's, quote, honorary, unquote, membership in the SS, and numerous programs in that series talk about some of the developments in that particular regard. We're going to come back to that in a second. I would note, however, that Bertelsmann, the third largest media conglomerate in the world, is doing very, very nicely indeed from an economic standpoint. The following is from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, June 26th of the year 2000. This is an article from the World Watch Europe section headlined, Bertelsmann Fiscal Year Sales Rise 23%. It reads, Germany's Bertelsmann said sales for its fiscal year ending June 30th rose an estimated 23% to 32 billion marks, or $15.34 billion, boosted by the consolidation of its CLT, UFA, television, and radio unit, and growth across its media businesses. By the way, that unit was something that we talked about at the beginning of For the Record program number 238. We also noted that in connection with the aforementioned cuddling up to the British company Pearson. Continuing. The company said the sales increase solidified its position in the world's third largest as the world's third largest media company measured by sales. Bertelsmann also said that because it made no large acquisitions in the past year, its war chest stands at 15 billion marks, quote, at full height for strategic investments, unquote. And I would note that those strategic investments would appear to be forthcoming. And we're going to take a look right now at some of those strategic investments in the field of publishing, including and especially magazine publishing right now. We're going to begin by taking a look at the resignation of Bertelsmann's CEO, Mark Woessner, W-O-E-S-S-N-E-R. This from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, May 22nd of the year 2000. An article by William Boston, spelled just like in the Massachusetts city. Its headline, Bertelsmann Stalwart Exits Amid Fight. And it reads in part, Mark Woessner, the 61-year-old chairman of the supervisory board of Bertelsmann AG, will leave the company after 32 years, ending a dispute with founder Reinhard Mohn and strengthening the position of chief executive Thomas Mittelhoff, who is trying to transform the German publishing house into a global multimedia and e-commerce company. Note the past article talking about Bertelsmann's expansion. Skipping down, speaking of Woessner, note the other companies on whose advisory boards he sits. Speaking of Woessner, the article says, he already advises Deutsche Bank AG Chairman and Chief Executive Rolf Breuer and is on the supervisory board of Daimler Chrysler AG. Mr. Woessner couldn't be reached for comment. Mr. Woessner's departure underscores the Mohn family's continued clout on a company with 29 billion marks revenue, or 13.25 billion a year, and interest ranging from German newspapers and book clubs to Random House, the world's largest book publisher, BMG, the music company, a 50% stake in Europe's largest broadcaster, and stakes in a portfolio of internet businesses. Note that Mark Woessner on the board of directors of Deutsche Bank and also Daimler Chrysler, two of the major German corporations, and the interlocking nature of the major German corporations, something that I've spoken about in the past in connection with German corporate control over American media, and in particular in connection with the deadly Bormann Flight Capital organization about which I've spoken so many times. What we're going to take a look at now is Bertelsmann's role in the magazine world, and we're going to begin by returning to an article that we looked at last in For the Record Program 238, the preceding half-hour segment. This is an article from the Nation magazine's issue of November 8th of 1999. It's an article by Hirsch Fischler, F-I-S-C-H-L-E-R, and John Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. It's called Bertelsmann's Revisionist, and it's about a Bertelsmann house historian Dirk Bavendam, last name B-A-V-E-N-D-A-M-M. Bavendam, as noted, is the house historian for the Bertelsmann firm, and in both 1983 and 1998, he published books that blamed World War II on American imperialism, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, American or Jewish control over American media, claimed they gave that American media gave a false picture of Hitler, and claimed that Franklin Roosevelt started World War II, and that Hitler's policy against the Jews was simply a reaction to Roosevelt's strategy against Germany. For people who are tapping their foot with impatience at my frequent discussion of the book Serpent's Walk, just check out the viewpoint evidenced by the third largest media conglomerate in the world and one that owns American publishing. We're going to take a look now at the Stern magazine Hitler Diaries scandal, one which helped to drive Stern magazine to the right. Stern is a major German news magazine. From Bertelsmann's Revisionist of 11-8-99, this again from the Nation magazine's issue of that date, we read, in 1980, Bertelsmann's Stern magazine published poems and illustrations supposedly written and drawn by Hitler during World War I under the title Rhymes by Private First Class H. Dirk Bavendam, 61-year-old German historian who had been instrumental in helping Stern obtain the material, wrote an accompanying article noting that the poems and drawings show Hitler as an ordinary soldier. In one illustration, a German soldier gently holds a baby. In another, a soldier helps a mother lying in bed while a baby nestles in a cradle. Subsequently, the poems and drawings were determined to be forgeries. Later, Bertelsmann patron Reinhard Mohn gave the green light to a Bertelsmann division to purchase the Hitler diaries by the same forger which also showed a milder Hitler. They were published in Stern in 1983. Bavendam's career was not affected. He went on, by the way, to become, as we've looked at, the house historian for Bertelsmann. Note that the Mohn there was Reinhard Mohn, whose protege Dieter Vogel was. Dieter Vogel became head of the Thyssen Group. His father, Heinrich Mohn, was a, quote, honorary member of the SS. We're going to take a look now at some of the background of and effects of the Hitler Diaries scandal, something that my late colleague Mae Brussel charged ultimately channeled money to the renascent Nazi cause. We're going to take a look now at the book Global Dreams, subtitled Imperial Corporations in the New World Order, that was co-authored by Richard J. Barnett and John Kavanaugh, published in hardcover by Simon Schuster, and copyright 1994. The ISBN number, by the way, is 0-671-63377-5. Writing of Reinhard Mohn's stern dictatorial policies towards the various publications or periodicals that Bertelsmann ran, speaking of Mohn, the authors here write, "He personally stopped the publication of Rolf Hochhuth's The Deputy, a devastating attack on Pope Pius XII for collaborating with Hitler, after it had been set in type." By the way, a recent book entitled Hitler's Pope confirms that information. That is discussed at great length, by the way, in RFA program number 17, the first of a five-part series about the shooting of the Pope, the program number 17, RFA program 17, entitled Fascism in the Vatican. Continuing. "In 1976, the acting editor of Stern, Manfred Bissinger, already considered too far left by Bertelsmann management, published an article about Germany's leading tax evaders and capital exporters, a list that included Reinhard Mohn himself. But he lacked the evidence to pin down his charges, and to the astonishment of no one but himself, was fired. According to a former Stern editor, Mark Wosner, Bertelsmann's CEO, now insists on being told in advance what will be in the magazine each week." And skipping down of the Hitler scandal, the Hitler's diary scandal, excuse me. "In 1983, Stern's editor-in-chief, Peter Koch, K-O-C-H, with the approval of top Bertelsmann executives, almost certainly including Reinhard Mohn, paid more than 9 million marks for Hitler's diaries and exploded into print. The find of the century," unquote, carried the endorsement of a famous Oxford professor. "The exposure of these bogus notebooks as a forgery, a clumsy one at that, was humiliating for a company that prided itself on prudence and meticulous preparation. The magazine had built its reputation on being right in its sensational exposés, and it never fully recovered from the fiasco." Skipping down, speaking of Gerd Schultehillen, who headed up the magazine division of Bertelsmann, "He took over the magazine division just as the super-secret Hitler deal was being concluded, and he was the one who approved the checks. Even 10 years after the event, questions about the hoax push this highly articulate, cool executive to the brink of incoherence as he tries to explain how he was taken in by a cast of improbable characters and overwhelmed by a chain of implausible events. The reporter who procured the notebooks was a secret Hitler freak and proud possessor of Goering's bathrobe." Skipping down, I would note that the Hitler's Diaries fiasco led to a pushing of Stern to the right and dismissal of editors. Speaking of Mark Wosner, who recently resigned as the head of Bertelsmann, "According to a former Stern editor, Mark Wosner, Bertelsmann's CEO, now insists on being told in advance what will be in the magazine each week. Nine editors have been dismissed since the Hitler fiasco. Michael Jurgs, the ninth to fall, believes that his skepticism about reunification was the reason why Schultehillen handed him a 3 million mark golden parachute exactly 4 weeks after being signed to a new 4-year contract." I would note that the architect of German reunification was Günter Strassmayr, whose father was one of the early members of the Nazi Party under Hitler, and whose son, according to Carol Howe, was the architect of the Oklahoma City bombing. His attorney, that is to say Andreas Strassmayr's attorney, was Kirk Lyons, about whom we've spoken before. Continuing with this section of Global Dreams, Reinhard Mohn and his top managers in Gütersloh decided to discipline the Stern magazine for the Hitler scandal by forcing a man of pronounced conservative views on his demoralized staff. The publisher of Kapital, Johannes Gross, and the well-known writer Peter Scholl-Latour were appointed editors, but the staff occupied the magazine's offices and Mohn hired someone else. In the early 1990s, a former editor-in-chief at West German Television who had served as a public relations man for Bertelsmann took over. The magazine is under control. No longer the free spirit it was, Stern causes Bertelsmann less trouble and still makes money. So please note that the Hitler Diary scandal, among other things, caused Stern magazine to undergo some serious editorial and viewpoint changes, which pushed it to the right. Note also the role of Reinhard Mohn in that particular fiasco. Note also that Dirk Bavendam was the individual who approved the drawings by Private H, which presented a kinder, gentler Adolf Hitler along the lines of the behavior modification and image changes that the book Serpent's Walk talks about. Now, bearing in mind some of the history of the Bertelsmann's involvement in magazine publishing, please note the following, and note this also in the context of Serpent's Walk. This from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, May 22nd of the year 2000. This is an article by Matthew Rose, headlined Bertelsmann to Tap Time Incorporated Executive to Head Gruner & Jahr. It reads in part, despite its best effort, German media giant Bertelsmann AG has never been a major force in the American magazine market. Now it is betting a veteran U.S. magazine executive can make it so. Bertelsmann is expected to announce today that it has tapped American Express Publishing Corporation Chief Executive Daniel B. Brewster as Chief Executive of its Gruner & Jahr magazine operations in the U.S., according to executives familiar with the situation. Quote, we want to be number one in all businesses, and we are not number one in the U.S. magazine business, said Bertelsmann Chief Executive Thomas Middelhoff at a press conference last year. Tired of being an also-ran in the U.S., Gruner & Jahr has now charged its new high-profile new CEO with doubling the $400 million operation through launches and acquisitions to establish the company firmly alongside industry leaders such as Time Warner Incorporated's Time Incorporated and the Neuhaus family's Condé Nast publications. Armed with roughly $8 billion from the sale of its stake in AOL Europe, Bertelsmann is in a position to make acquisitions. According to executives familiar with the company's strategy, it is bidding on closely held Incorporated magazine, which bears an asking price between $200 and $300 million. Spokeswomen for Bertelsmann, the Neuhaus family, and Inc. declined to comment. That would appear to be a fairly accurate prognostication, as the following bears witness. This from the Los Angeles Times of Wednesday, June 21st of the year 2000. In the Heard on the Beat, we read, Gruner & Jahr buys Industry Magazine, Inc. Gruner & Jahr, the magazine publisher owned by German media conglomerate Bertelsmann, is buying a small business magazine, Inc. The deal, which was announced to the staff Tuesday, marks the first acquisition under Gruner & Jahr's new chief executive, Dan Brewster, who came aboard late last month from American Express Publishing. Inc., by the way, is spelled I-N-C. Spitfire, by the way, the tape duplication service that stocks these various tapes, is spelled S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email, mail at spitfirelist.com. Website, spitfirelist.com. Equipped with real audio, look for article-length descriptions, now footnoted in the For the Record section. That concludes For the Record Program 239. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.